Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
In this episode, Dr. Hope Christie meets Dr. Kerry Montgomery, psychological wellbeing lead at Alopecia UK. Kerry's academic background is in psychology, and she has spent 15 years working in mental health, supporting people with anxiety and depression. Her PhD looked at managing the psychological impact of skin conditions which are visible. Kerry's work has involved developing psychological interventions for those with conditions which affect appearance, including self-help, group-based interventions, one-to-one and peer support. Having worked across a number of national charities, Kerry has become one of the leading experts in low-intensity interventions and peer support for those with visible difference. As psychological wellbeing lead at Alopecia UK, Kerry leads on the provision of psychosocial support materials and helps raise awareness of the psychological impact of alopecia, which includes leading and directing psychological research.
Okay, welcome Kerry. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're going to obviously unpack and get into all the great work that you do at Alopecia UK. But before we get into that, start off really nice and basic for everybody. Could you tell us what is alopecia?
Yeah, of course. So alopecia is a term, basically means hair loss. So obviously that can mean any type of hair loss. It's just that's what the term is. There are lots of different types of hair loss, but probably too many to sort of mention today. But I think there are sort of the main ones that we'll discuss probably later on. Some of those including alopecia areata, so that's a type of hair loss that is patchy or can lead to complete hair loss. But there's other types such as telogen effluvium, which is more around a body's response to things like infection or trauma, and that hair loss often can come back. So lots of different types, lots of different causes and prognoses, really. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, along with the different types, I suppose the reactions are kind of the impacts to people's well-being can also vary then, I suppose, with the different types as well. Just because you were mentioning one there that maybe the hair might come back, whereas maybe with alopecia areata, if I've said that right, then there maybe the hair wouldn't grow back or might not come back.
I mean, with alopecia areata, it can grow back, but it's less certain. There's other types where if it's a response to an infection, then once that infection's cleared and the body's recovered, then it's much more likely the hair's coming back. Whereas with things like alopecia areata, it's very uncertain. So it could come back, but don't know when or how and what that might look like. So there's a lot of uncertainty to manage around the condition. And yes, I think you're right in that it definitely affects people in different ways. And also, I think that, what stage in life you're at has a huge part to play in how you respond to something like a visible difference.
That's perfect. Thank you, Kerry. I think we can unpack that more as we chat about the different types, although I'll not test you on how many there are. You can list them all.
So many. Very complicated names.
Yeah.
So, I'm hoping I say them all correctly or someone listening will be like, she said that wrong.
No, that's perfect. And I know that there are so many different types because they're all listed on your website, Alopecia UK. And actually, there's so much that your organisation does that I was getting just from looking at it. So I don't know if you want to take some time now to tell us about Alopecia UK and what your organisation does.
Yep. So we're a national charity supporting people in the UK. We have, our main aim is really just supporting those affected by alopecia. When we say affected, we say that because it means people who have hair loss themselves, but also their families and the wider network. So We speak to a lot of parents, for example, partners of people with alopecia. So really, it's the whole network of people who might be affected by it on an emotional level. But we also work with people to promote awareness of what alopecia is and what the impact is. And I think, you know, the mission is to improve the lives of those with alopecia. And we do that. We've got three main aims, which are support, awareness, and research. And through those aims, we target certain things.
Brilliant. Thank you. And actually, that leads me really nicely onto my next question, which was the main streams that you talked about there, support, awareness and research. So I wonder if you could just take a minute there to talk us through each of those streams and what they involve.
Yeah. So with support, that's maybe quite obvious. It's supporting those affected directly. So we do that through, we've got a network of support groups. So these are run by volunteers who have personal connections. It might be that they themselves have alopecia, or it might be a parent running it because a child has it. So they're all people that have been personally affected. So they deliver that peer support. And we believe quite strongly in peer support because it's about being around people who get it.
Yeah.
And being around people who understand the impact that it can have. So we also do online groups as well. And for children, we do meetups and play games and, you know, go to cool places. And that's because often for the children, just being around others is enough, and just seeing someone else that looks like you. They don't necessarily want to sit down and talk about their feelings and emotions. It's just enough to sort of go and be active with others that look the same as you. So that's, we do regional and national events as well. And again, that's a time for people to get together. And we do education around the research that's out there, but also how you can manage your alopecia. So things like wigs and eyebrows and learning about what to do to sort of camouflage if that's the route that you want to go down. So that's our support aim.
Okay, yeah.
There's lots of other things within that that we do, but I think broadly it is, you know, providing that peer support. So in terms of awareness, as a charity, we are hoping to raise awareness of what alopecia is, just so the general public know a bit more about it. There's a lot of stigma around people seeing somebody with total hair loss and thinking that they're having chemotherapy treatment. And I think the more we know about alopecia, the more that there's not going to be that instant, if we see someone that doesn't have hair, that we could think, oh, they're having treatment. So we raise awareness around the public, but also around healthcare professionals, teachers, basically anyone that's in a position where they are having contact with those with hair loss, such as employers, hairdressers, everyone, to say, this is what hair loss is, and this is the impact that it can have. Because we know from the research, and we know from, obviously, as a charity, the people we speak to, that hair loss has a significant impact on people's well-being. So that's where we work with awareness. We'll do things like we'll speak to professionals at conferences. We've developed the Schools Pack, which is a resource for teachers to help them understand the impact of alopecia on young people. And we've also developed training programmes for healthcare professionals as well.
Brilliant.
In terms of the research side, we've now been in a position where we can fund research into the causes and treatments of alopecia. And we've been funding research over the past few years, but it's not just about the funding. We also provide support to researchers to say that, you know, we can support them with patient and public involvement. So what would they like to know, and we can facilitate that. We often send out research studies so that people can engage, because we have a lot of people in our community and they really want their voices to be heard. Actually, they're a very engaged community. So when people send things out, we get quite high levels of responses. So that's our research sort of side.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And some of my background was in research and that kind of, like you say, that patient public involvement and actually making sure that their voices are heard is so important. So that's fantastic that you're also working on that side and you've got such a great response rate and people are keen to be involved. That's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the awareness raising, and I personally learned a lot when I was looking through your website, around the different types of alopecia, I was really surprised to learn just how many there were. And I obviously won't quiz you on all of them now. But can you talk us through some of the different types, if there's maybe main ones that you see more than others or what some of the different types are?
Yeah. I mean, I think particularly as we'll be talking about young people, the main type that we see for young people is alopecia areata. So that is a type of hair loss that is autoimmune. It's an autoimmune condition, and it's whereby, you know, it presents as you might start with patches. So sometimes it's said like a 50 pence piece patch, and you might get one or two. And that's it. That's the extent of it. And your hair might grow back. So it really does vary for everybody. Some people find that they get more and more patches and eventually the patches meet up and then the hair loss becomes more extensive. And that hair loss can progress into total loss of hair on their head, but it can also progress to total loss of body hair. So that's all hair, eyebrows, hair everywhere.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a progression. So when we talk about alopecia areata, we're talking about the patchy hair loss, but also hair loss that can be just, you know, complete loss of hair on the head, but also the body. So the subtypes within that.
Yeah.
That is the most common one we really see for young people. And then there's other types, like there's the telogen effluvium, which I mentioned, I think, earlier. So this is a type that is a response to infection or the body being unwell, and that is likely to, when the body's got over the infection, can come back. And we saw, you know, an increase in people experiencing that over COVID. What we saw with COVID was the fever, the temperature spike, and obviously an infection within the body. So some people experienced telogen effluvium during that time. But actually what they found was after they'd recovered from COVID, you know, not immediately, the body needs time to recover from infection, but after they'd done that, the hair gradually returned to its normal state. There's other types as well that are more common in sort of in adulthood, later life. So we've got sort of androgenetic alopecia, and this is more commonly referred to in the public domains, or better known as male or female patterned hair loss.
Okay.
So that's the sort of hair loss that we get that's often associated with, say, menopause in women, where the front of the hairline starts and the men start to recede. So that's obviously much more common, as I said, in later life. But nonetheless can be really distressing, and often it's the extent to which it happens. So for some people, we might get a receding, or we might get hair thinning as we get older, and, you know, it doesn't cause too much of a problem depending on how you style your hair and what you're used to. But for others, it could cause a really significant change in appearance and styling.
Yeah, and I know that you mentioned that as well when we were talking about the different types to begin with, and you're mentioning that actually it can have different effects and must be really dependent on the kind of age and stage of the person as well. So especially, I suppose, for young people, that kind of appearance can be really important to them if they're trying to fit in and be kind of similar to their peers at school, and actually they've got this thing that kind of is difficult to hide, or to kind of it makes them stand out a little bit. I can imagine that could be quite difficult for the young people that you see.
Yeah, and I think what we're saying, isn't it, about the age of the child is important, because with younger children, they just haven't had that exposure to, you know, society and norms and values, have they? So the whole thing around, is appearance important? Well, you know, at 3, 4, and 5, the only thing that's important is, you know, who you're going to play with tomorrow, what sandpits the best, and, you know, those sorts of things. So they've not really had the, they've been very lucky and often not been exposed to this whole thing around what appearance means in society.
Sure.
So as children get older, looking different to everybody else starts to become something they notice. So they start to think, actually, why haven't I got hair when all my friends have got hair? And then when that starts to come into play, there's almost like a bit of a critical period for parents and anyone involved with the child, teachers as well, whereby we have to manage that quite delicately and say, well, everybody's different, and help and support them around that, saying, well, that's okay. You know, some people have got brown hair, some people have got blonde hair. You know, you don't have hair, and that's okay, because you're still you and you still have all these wonderful things about you. But even so, it is hard to look different in a society which, there's no way around it, values appearance. We just, you know, the media, social media, everything, it's just sort of put in front of our faces every day, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, like you say, maybe for 3, 4, 5 year olds, the appearance maybe isn't top of their priority list at that time.
Yeah.
They can kind of get on with their things because, like you say, society's kind of norms haven't really impacted them yet. But I suppose maybe for school age children, or like you say, that when they're becoming more aware of their appearance and looking different, and I suppose society's norms or expectations around appearance, that I can imagine must be really difficult for them. But I like that message around encouraging them to kind of celebrate them for them, and you know, all these other lovely qualities that they have, and that it's okay. Like you say, some people have brown hair, some people have blonde hair, you don't have any hair, but that's okay, and celebrating these other great things. Could you talk us through a little bit about, and I'm probably thinking more around that school age bracket then, when children are starting to become more aware of their appearance, how might alopecia affect those children and their families at that time?
Yeah, so what we find, in terms, start with the families really. So obviously for younger children, thinking, just taking it back a little bit, younger children, it's often the parents who are more upset and distressed by their child having alopecia, because the child, to them, they've not sort of, like we said, got to that point where its appearance is something that's important to them. So it's often the parents that can become quite troubled, because they worry about the future. They worry about what is going to happen to their child. So as we get to school age and the child becomes more aware of it, the distress sort of shifts sometimes. So the parents still, you know, often very upset, but the child starts to, you know, starts to take that, some of that on, because maybe classmates have said things, you know, people are starting to talk about their alopecia, they're starting to notice. So I think when other people start to notice, they almost bring it to your attention. So it's like, well, I know I've got no hair, but you keep bringing it up every day. So it's like they can go through life, they know it, they can see themselves, they know exactly what's going on. But then when people keep bringing something to your attention, it starts to become an issue, doesn't it? So it's like, oh, okay, that again, I've got to think about it again now. So the types of things that people, or the younger people as they start school, start to experience are things like, I look different to everybody else, and everybody else keeps telling me I look different to everybody else. So what does that mean about me? And it often becomes a source of shame for them. So it's looking different to everybody else becomes a problem rather than something to be almost celebrated. It's like, well, it's okay to be different. You know, those lovely books, there's a lot of lovely books on it about celebrate difference. It's okay to be you. But actually, in reality, it's very hard for the child to take that on board, because they look around and everybody else just looks different to them. So there can be elements where they're constantly getting picked up on it by other children, whether you would call that bullying or just, why haven't you got any hair? You know, just questions and it.
Yeah, I suppose children are sometimes not the best at filtering questions.
Yeah, there's not much tact involved, is there? It's quite straight to the point. But, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, helpful, because then it's like, well, I've got alopecia, it's a condition, it's an autoimmune condition, and they explain it, and then hopefully the other child goes, okay then, now I know, I'll leave that alone. Other children are obviously not quite so kind, but yeah, so they start to notice they're different to others, and that might then start to be the time where they want to fit in, and it might be when things like wigs and or hats for boys get discussed. They don't feel like they stand out so much, and that's a really difficult thing for parents to navigate, because often they may say, well, you know, you're you and you're beautiful and don't hide it. But it's striking that balance of helping the child to feel comfortable, but also not feel ashamed of being their authentic self as well.
Absolutely. And I thought it was really interesting. You talked about it a little bit where you mentioned the word camouflage, which I thought was an interesting word to use, because I suppose it must be so difficult for a parent, like you say, to navigate that balance of wanting to support their child and of wanting to kind of do whatever's going to make them feel more comfortable and better. And, you know, like you say, some kids can be very unkind with the words that they choose to use. So yeah, on the one hand, as a parent, you're wanting to do the best by your child, but then on the other hand, I suppose as a parent, you know, they want to celebrate how their child looks and their appearance and mm-hmm. and not have them hide away. So yeah. And what advice or any tips that you could give to parents that might be struggling in that situation right now?
I think it's like wigs and hats and all those types of things. It's very much about being child-led and helping them to understand, you know, what wearing a wig entails. So it's about saying that, and especially for younger children, so wigs are not, you know, they're not the most comfortable things. And if a child is very active and sporty, you've got to consider whether it is the right thing for them at that point. Because if they're going to take it off when they're doing those activities and then put it back on, is that creating more of an issue? Is that going to create more of a, well, you know, are people going to ask more questions? You know, is the child wanting to be like, this is my hair and I'm going to keep it on while I'm at school all the time? Or is it something I'm going to choose to take off and put on as and when? So a child has to understand that, you know, they're not the most comfortable, although you can buy lots of different types. When they're doing sports, you've got to consider that. And then the child looking after the wig as well. So when they're at school, you know, things like swimming, PE, they're all things that need to be considered. With that in mind, if the child still decides that they do want to wear a wig or a cap, in the house, maybe trying to encourage them, well, you're home from school now, you're just with us, it's okay to be you, you know, so that they're not wearing it constantly, for example, so that they're still having time where they're not wearing it, where they can receive that positive encouragement. You know, it's a tough one with wigs, because people would say, well, surely if they're wearing a wig, that's encouraging them not to be their authentic self. For us, it's about choice. As a charity, we promote choice for all. And if people choose to wear a wig, that's their choice. If they choose not to, that's fine as well. It's whichever way they want to be viewed, because, it, you know, they had their hair taken away and that's not their fault.
Uh-huh, yeah. But I like that approach as well, though, of it being child-led. So like you say, you're presenting, obviously it would depend on the age of the child, but you're presenting the options to them to say, well, you know, if you want to wear a wig, then, you know, it might be uncomfortable. I know parents have a hard enough time kind of keeping like a bucket hat or something on their child when it's sunny outside.
Exactly. Well,
let alone kind of keeping a wig on their head, especially if they're running around or kind of playing sport. I hadn't even thought of all the different contexts in which that might be an issue.
Roller coasters, you know, going to theme parks. There's There's and you don't really think about it until you're in that position. And I think that's where, for, you know, it's hard for a lot of parents because you are having to navigate a new world where nobody ever really considers, you know, the problems that going to the beach with their child might be, you know, like an 8-year-old, for example. Like I took my kids to the beach the other day, they're 7 and 8. You have to think about those things. As a parent, you know, you've got to watch. If you're going in the sea, that's not going to work very well.
No.
So there are a lot of considerations, and I think this is where sometimes parents do feel like they get a bit tied up in knots with it. It's hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually going to ask you as well, is there advice that your organisation offers or kind of support that your organisation offers just uniquely for parents? Because like you say, they're navigating a brand new world now, and there's obviously lots of things that I'm sure come up quite a lot where, you know, they want to do the best by their child, but like you say, might get themselves tied up in knots a bit, and it's difficult to know what is the best thing to do. So is there support there available for parents as well?
Yes. So we have children and young people's groups, and as part of those, the parents come along and the children go and do their activity, or they, you know, and then the parents get that time to chat amongst themselves. But we also have a parents online Facebook group as well. And we've had online meetings that are just for parents. And we specifically say, please don't bring your child along, because it's a chance for them to talk about things that maybe, and say things that might, they might not necessarily say in front of a child, because we don't want the child to know all of our worries and concerns. So yes, so we do that. And on the website, we have a parents section of parents resources. So I've written alongside parents and other colleagues in the charity things about managing your own emotions when your child is diagnosed with alopecia, you know, how to manage your child's emotions as well. And then, you know, navigating the school systems and things like that. In terms of the practicalities, like wigs and, you know, what can you do with them? Because, again, it is tricky to know how to keep a wig. You should obviously be given all that information when your child is fitted. But we do, again, have a Facebook group where you can ask those sorts of questions and you get that really sort of live, you know, instantaneous practical advice from others that sort of get it. And they have, you know, top tips from parents. And it's good that it's parents sharing with parents, because then it's like mum hacks, isn't it? But in a different context. It's mum hacks for mums and dads also with alopecia.
Yeah, and that's, I think it comes back to what you were saying before about that peer support. And I think that can be so important to hear it from someone else who gets it, or hear it from someone else who's maybe gone through it already and can say, you know, well, here's maybe things to that I've learned along the way that you might want to avoid this and do this instead, or maybe try this out. And like you say, it's that kind of live instantaneous feedback from what I imagine must be a very supportive, encouraging group.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, no, you know, when you're going through something, it is helpful to hear from other people who have gone through similar, because as much as people can say that sounds really hard, I think unless they're in it and living it, there's a degree to which they're a bit more detached and don't really understand. And some people, you know, in wider families will say to parents, well, you know, at least it's only their hair. At least, you know, they've just lost their hair and it's nothing more serious. And they're trying, they're not trying to be cruel, they're trying to be helpful and say, you know, well, they're trying to sort of give them some encouragement, but actually it just makes them feel worse because they're having all these feelings and worries, and that's just really invalidating.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like you say, they're obviously trying to be helpful and it's coming from a nice place, but actually it's not really that helpful at all.
Yeah, I think when we think about mental health generally, you know, people often say, don't they, you know, with people with anxiety, like, oh, just, you know, just take some deep breaths and calm down. It's like, well, it doesn't quite work that way, does it? Because if that was the key to it all, everything would be fine. And, you know, for us, Alopecia UK wouldn't exist if it was as simple as telling children to, you know, just embrace it and move on. you know, it's not that easy and it's not that quick. And I think the other thing that's important is that it's not linear either. So where people might be struggling one point, then they might, you know, turn a corner, something might change, they feel a bit better, but then something happens later down the line and then their mood dips. So we found with some children that, and again, I don't want to worry any parent that's got a child with alopecia who's doing okay, but it might be that they seem to be doing well in a younger period and you think, okay, we've got this. And then they sort of reach teenage years and then, you know, their mood changes and then they maybe start to find it a bit more difficult. But that's not to say that their mood won't shift again. And I think the thing we need to remember about young people is there's a lot of hormones going on, and that's going to play a part in it too. So when people ask me about managing any anxiety or low mood around alopecia, very often it is the techniques that we would use in general mental health. You know, it's looking at anxiety management and relaxation and focusing on the things that they do have control over rather than the things that they don't, like their hair growth.
Yeah, that's great. And I think really important for people to hear that maybe do have a child who does have alopecia. And like you say, you know, it might be that there are periods where things are going well and it's like, yeah, we've got this down pat, we're going good. And then things might change. But as you point out, it's I think everybody that's listening that's got a teenager knows that their mood might change as quick as the wind blows in a different direction. So, but good to know that it's very similar to the mental health advice that you would give for general mental health as opposed to anything specifically related to.
What we're managing is an anxiety around, you know, what other people think of us. And we know that for lots of teenagers, that can be a big issue as well. You know, wanting to appear a certain way to peers. And that, you know, same for adults as well, isn't it? We all want to present a certain image to us of ourselves, to the world. And if that isn't something we're projecting, then that can cause anxiety for us. I think the things that parents can do is think about the things that they can control. So it's about the narrative that we have as in the house. So, for example, you know, when we're stood in front of the mirror going, oh, you know, I think I don't look great in these jeans, I feel a bit fat today. Those types of appearance-related comments, you know, subconsciously we're sort of giving the impression that appearance is important. You know, we're considering and we're thinking about appearance. And actually, you know, we need to try and shift the narrative into encouraging children and looking at things that they are good at outside of their appearance. So when we are giving praise, you know, we might say, oh, you look really lovely. And that's fine. Like, we're not saying don't tell them they look nice. But it's also saying that you did great at that sport today, or you're a really kind person. And it's giving them holistic compliments, isn't it? And I'm probably teaching people to suck eggs, and I'm sure lots of people do that. But sometimes, and I have to do this as well, because we're so ingrained, it's so ingrained into us with society, but I'm very mindful of how we speak about appearance in the house.
Yeah, I think that's really important because, like you say, I think it almost just rolls off the tongue. You say, like, oh, you looked really nice in that outfit, or like you know, I was just about to say you suit your hair that way, or you like, you know, that it just rolls off the tongue and it's normal to say those things. And like you say, it's not that you're discouraging from people doing that, but it's also important to, like you say, showcase and champion these other qualities that they've got, which comes back to what you were talking about before, is that you know, that just because you don't have hair, you're still you still are kind and caring and empathetic and like a nice friend, or you know, good at your sport, or there's lots of other qualities that make you over and above your hair.
Yeah, and similarly with what we would do with maybe all children is, you know, I'd encourage parents to think about the sorts of activities and clubs that their child does. So it's really good for all children to have a varied range of activities that they do, sort of either inside or outside of school. Because I remember being a young person and sort of falling out with friends in school, but that was sort of not as bad because I had a group of friends outside of school that I went to dance class with. So, you know, there were always people there, even when there were problems within one particular friendship group, that was okay because I had another friendship group. And it maybe made it not seem quite as difficult. So I think it's giving them lots of opportunities to do things. But as much as children can, you know, sometimes say unkind things, you know, we have to also say that there is a role for adults within this as well, like teachers within that school environment, you know, they need to be aware of what's happening at break times and dinner times, and ensuring that if people are making comments, that that is something they're very strong on dealing with there and then.
Yeah, and that's really helpfully brings me on to my next question. We've chatted a lot about solutions for parents, which has all been really helpful. And I know you did mention a school pack that Alopecia UK offers. So I don't know if you want to talk us through a little bit about what the pack involves, and then we can maybe chat a little bit more about some practical solutions and suggestions for teachers.
So the pack was developed by myself with teachers, with young people, parents, and it's basically lesson plans. So there's lesson plans within there. We've got three packs that are aimed at the at different age groups, so all the way up to age 16. So the lesson plans are very much around education around what alopecia is, but hopefully done in a way that's age appropriate. So drawing, you know, germs attacking the hair follicles and things like that for the younger ones. Also talking about, you know, what appearance means and some case studies and things like that. And then there's notes for the teachers of how to deliver those lessons and what the key sort of things that they need to be drawing from the pupils are. And it's all been designed in line with the national curriculums in the different sort of in Ireland, Wales, Scotland, England. There's also resources, so books that are age appropriate, again, of what they could be reading in class, and not always about alopecia. Some of them are just about difference and diversity. And then there's the teacher training, which I think is probably one of the really important bits of the pack, which tells teachers, you know, not only what alopecia is, but also the impact that it can have and why it can have that impact. So, for example, you know, again, with a child with anxiety, you might see problems with memory and problems with retaining, you know, doing work, because all their cognitive resources are sort of being used up because they're worrying about other things. So it's important to acknowledge that there may be anxieties in the classroom, worries about break times, worries about interacting with peers, and what they should be looking out for and noticing, and how they could potentially manage that in the school environment, whether that's about their policies around bullying and also wig wearing too, and hats. So yeah, so it's a bumper pack when you look at it. There is a lot in there.
Yeah, it sounds like there is a lot. Yeah,
we do encourage schools to have that open dialogue, and so some children that have been in touch with us have actually delivered whole class or whole assembly presentations about alopecia.
Amazing.
I know, they've been amazing doing that. But if a child doesn't feel comfortable and they're happy for the teacher to do it, the teacher can do that. And it's almost like, right, I'm going to nip this in the bud now. I'm going to tell you what it is, and then we don't need to ask any more questions. So yeah, but I think the thing is with everything really, it's nipping it in the bud early. So if we can teach children really young that difference is okay and diverse and all about diversity of all types, then they're more likely they're going to be more accepting as they get older.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we've had some questions through from teachers before that have students in their classrooms currently that have alopecia, and they were, yeah, I think that their questions were about how do you speak about it to the students, do you know, broadly raise an awareness. And it sounds like actually there's a lot of really helpful information in that schools pack that you've just talked about.
Yeah, I think the main thing is that we, again, a bit like the mental health side of things, is that we just say what it is. You know, we say that If it's alopecia areata, it's an autoimmune condition. It doesn't mean that they're sick. It doesn't, you know, impact their abilities in any way. You know, they're still them. They still have their friends and their, you know, activities and all the things they do. It's just that they look different. And then tying that in as well then with a session around diversity generally and acknowledging that there are, you know, lots of things that make us different from each other. Some things are visible and some things are not. So some, you know, some people within schools have things that, you know, like diabetes or, you know, invisible conditions, maybe tying it in with that as well. So you're really covering the broad range of things that can affect young people that we just need to be more accepting.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good example there about tying it in with other conditions, because I wouldn't want like a child with alopecia in the classroom to feel like the spotlight's on them. So yeah, tying it in with maybe other conditions might be really helpful in terms of like, you know what I mean? It's not about like, okay, so this entire assembly or this entire class is going to be about the child with alopecia, but also like you say, you're raising awareness and advocating for kindness and acceptance for lots of different conditions that we might be able to see or we might not be able to see. And I think that's really, really important. And I know that we've talked about it a little bit, but, you know, bullying can be a problem in schools. And I wonder if you have, I'm sure that there's things in the resource pack, but I'm wondering if you have any practical advice for parents and also for teachers, I know there'll be different settings, but to deal with bullying from other children.
Yeah, I think with bullying, it really depends on where it's happening. So I think within the school environment, you know, schools should all have this zero tolerance policies. But I know in practice, you can't cover every inch of those playgrounds and slickets, you know, in alleyways and what have you. So, and things can be subtle, you know, people say things as they're walking past. But it's about encouraging an open dialogue with the person with alopecia and saying, you know, if something happens, you just need to come and tell us and we can manage that, and giving them the confidence that you will deal with it. And then when they come to you or you hear anything, and just keeping that closer eye on certain groups of individuals if you know things are happening so that it can be managed. And actually, again, it is a zero tolerance that we would take them and we would educate them that actually they look different, but that's okay. And that, you know, it's a diversity issue, isn't it? It's an equality and diversity issue, what they're doing. It's the punishment needs to fit the crime. And actually, if you're making fun of somebody with a medical condition there,
yeah,
and they need to consider that when they are deciding what that punishment needs to be for bullying. And I think sometimes they do need to come down a bit harder to maybe prevent it from happening again. The problem with school is they have to go to and from school.
Yes.
And I find that that's when a lot of the problems are, like the school bus and then getting in and out of school because there's no one there. So then it's the parents and the school working together to see if there's a way that that can be managed. You know, can that child leave school early, a little bit earlier than their peers, so that they do feel more comfortable and safe walking home? Can they start school earlier or later? Again, so they've got that safety. It really has to be the parent and the child working together. And I'm not saying that, well, why should the child avoid it because it's not their fault, but we need them to feel safe. That's the important thing. So yeah, I'd think about, you know, doing all the preventative measures, making sure the punishment fits the crime, but also working with the child to see what would help them feel safer. You know, if they need to be in a separate part of the, you know, school building or in a school classroom with a friend, is that what they need?
Yeah, exactly. And I think as well, like you were saying, it might as well be helped along by the steps that came before. So, you know, raising awareness more generally. And like you see, you're at that point, bullying or making fun of a child with a medical condition. And really that's, I mean, bullying isn't okay on any front, but especially with that. But sometimes I suppose there's obviously a lot of reasoning behind why children do bully other children, but that might be helped by the greater understanding around alopecia and what those children might be going through and dealing with on a daily basis. And but like you say, if that isn't helping, then there's other solutions there, maybe for parents, teachers and that child to work together so that that child does feel safe and, you know, it's not a, doesn't end in a more extreme end of the scale where the child doesn't want to go to school anymore or that sort of thing happens.
I think what we were saying earlier as well about, you know, the lesson not being completely around, you know, spotlight on person with alopecia.
Yes.
You know, it's talking to the family and the child to see whether they want to be in that lesson as well. So it might be that they actually, they want the awareness to take place, but they don't want to be there for it. So it might be that they do something else during that period of time while that's happening. Not all will want that, but it's very much around being, again, teachers being child pupil led. That's not to say, you know, they get to miss maths or whatever. That's just saying if they prefer to sort of take a minute and go and sit somewhere quietly rather than having the spotlight, then I think that's okay too. And I know parents have delivered sessions as well, particularly for the younger age groups. The parents gone in and talked about it. You know, and then and educating the other children's parents, you know, so they get the message as well. So we that's with things like book bag letters.
Yeah, okay. So it can be really, yeah, as a really whole school community effort and involving all the parents and teachers to kind of make sure that as much awareness is being raised as possible.
Because I think what we need to remember, and like with anything, isn't it, when people bully, it's almost like, well, there's not really any, you know, we're bullying somebody because they've got no hair or because they've got this or that or the other. If we destigmatise all those things and say, well, you've sort of taken away their reasoning, aren't you? You sort of say, well, there's not. And yes, I know people will find all different types of reasons to bully, but if we create enough awareness and understanding that actually this is a medical thing that could happen to anyone at any time. So, you know, we just need to be mindful of that, that yes, it's happened to them, but, you know, what? How would you feel if it happened to you? Because it could have just as likely been you as them.
Exactly. Yeah, no, definitely. I agree. And, you know, we've covered a lot about like the amazing work that, that Alopecia UK does. And it's been great to kind of hear about the different streams and the services that you offer and the support and resource packs as well. Is there anything else that you would like people to know about Alopecia UK? You're maybe working on something now that you want people to know about, or yeah, is there any information? I'll give you the floor to share anything final about Alopecia UK with us.
Thank you. I think what I'd say is if there are any questions or people want advice, whether that's parents or professionals, then get in touch, and you know, we're more than happy to talk through things and try and help. And if there's anything that other people feel we could be doing more on or offering more support around, then, you know, where time permitting, there's things that we can think about. At the moment, I'm actually working on a transitions pack for children and youth, so that move particularly to secondary post, I don't know what it would be in all the different nations, but yeah, secondary school, we call it comprehensive. Moving up, because that's a big leap. It's a big jump at 11, and you're around people that are sort of 16, sometimes 18. So that's a huge thing to have to navigate. So we're doing something around that, and also a support leaflet for parents who are making school applications, because we know that can be really tricky when a child doesn't get the application to the school that the parent wants them to go to with their friends and their support network. That can be really tricky as well. So hopefully some tips in there as well. So I guess the two things are we are developing things, and get in touch if there's any questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Kerry, so much for your time. It's been really lovely to speak to you about alopecia in general and all the great work you're doing with Alopecia UK. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.